Okay. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. I hope we get through these teething problems. I've got a fairly long lecture today, so I'm going to talk quite fast. But I thought I just wanted to make the point before I start on this particular subject that for a historian like myself, history is not just a matter of telling the story of the past, trying to read up about the past, research on the past. The history is a sort of a dialogue between the past and the present, with our sources as the intermediary, part of the lens through which we come to understand the past. And I want to try and show that in these lectures. But to turn now to the camps. When I first started off working on the camps, the question that people asked me most frequently was this question about, was there ground glass in the sugar? I think I can say with reasonable confidence that there was not. But what interested me was the reason for asking that question. Why were so many people convinced that the British intent in the camps was genocidal? When did the story arise? How was it propagated? What, in fact, does the question tell us about the making of camp history and the way in which the camps are remembered? So in this lecture, then, I want to look partly at the question of memory and the making of myth. But before I do so, I want to remind you briefly a little about the background of the camps. One of the features of camp history is that it has tended until recently to be seen very narrowly as a history of the camps and nothing beyond that. It's certainly not seen in a broader international context. But increasingly now, there is research on a number of camps which existed at this time, and people are beginning to see these camps in different ways. So I want to look at that kind of context for a moment. Just to start off quickly by saying something about the position of the British Empire. By 1897, 1899, the British Empire still appeared to be the dominant global power. Much of the world is still painted red. But this was misleading, for by this period, by the end of the 19th century, Britain was being threatened particularly by other imperial powers, emergent powers. One of these, of course, was the expansionist United States. The United States is in its period of imperialism here at the end of the 19th century itself. Under President McKinley, the United States had engaged in a brief and successful war against Spain, and it's in these wars that she'd acquired Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines, and Hawaii became United States property in 1898. Teddy Roosevelt took America into a bloody imperial war in the Philippines at exactly the same time as our war, between 1899 and 1902. So there is the United States now as a major power emerging on the global scene. And then, of course, there was an increasingly militarist Germany. And Germany is looking at Africa, because let me remind you, this is also the period of the scramble for Africa. France, Portugal, Germany are all threatening Britain's hegemony in the south. So it was hardly surprising that Britain was twitchy. There was one major concern which Britain had also, because Britain was still preeminent as the financial power of the world. And this is a world based on the gold standard. Then in 1884, of course, the richest gold mines in the world were discovered in the little South African Republic. And for Britain, this was hugely important. When I make this point, I want to emphasize that when you look at the correspondence of, say, Joseph Chamberlain and Alfred Milner, they're not talking about gold. The mining magnates are not actually talking about imperial might. They're talking about increasing their profits or getting cheap labor or getting adequate labor, those sorts of things. But it's this concern about gold which underlies this period and the rise up to the war, the background to the war. So it's gold that underlies their concerns. And it was the control of rand gold that would ensure Britain's continued dominance in the world. So it was hugely important. I've just given you a little brief chronology of the lead up to the war. As I said, in 1884, gold was discovered on the rand. 1895-96, if you remember, was the Jameson Raid, when some of the mining magnates tried to instigate a rising to oust the Kruger government. May of 1897, Alfred Milner arrives as High Commissioner of South Africa and Governor of the Cape, and that really begins to ramp things up. 3rd of March of 1898 was Milner's Graaf Reinet speech, in which he outlines his views on the rights of the British subjects in the South African Republic. For our purposes, this dispute with the South African Republic is not presented as a quarrel about the control of gold. Much of it is presented in terms of human rights. And Milner keeps on doing this through this period. So that in December of 1898, for instance, you get the Edgar incident, when a British subject was shot by a Boer policeman, and this furthers these human rights claims against Kruger. And then on the 4th of May of 1899 came Milner's Helots dispatch, when he wrote to Chamberlain saying that the British subjects were slaves in the South African Republic, or little more than slaves, and the case for intervention was overwhelming. So by this time, to a very large extent, Milner has come to the conclusion that the only way out is war. Between the 31st of May and the 5th of June of 1899 was the failed Bloemfontein Conference, the negotiations between Kruger and Milner, in which Milner keeps on shifting the goalposts, and consequently the negotiations failed. And although there were continued negotiations in the period after the Bloemfontein Conference, essentially they came to nothing. And on the 11th of October of 1899 then, the South African Republic declared war on Britain. There are three phases to the war, and we're really only concerned with the last phase. But just to remind you briefly, there is the first stage when the Boers are on the offensive, lasting up to about May of 1900, with the period, the week of the 10th to the 15th of December, Black Week, as the kind of highlight for the Boers, when the British were defeated in those three battles of Stormberg, Colenso, and I've forgotten the third one for a moment.
Magersfontein,
thank you. The second phase is really with the British on the offensive, when they're marching north to Pretoria. And the turning point, as far as I can see, really is the Battle of Paardeberg with the surrender of Cronier. On the 13th of March 1900, Bloemfontein was occupied. On the 5th of June, Pretoria fell to the British. And shortly after that, the two Boer republics were annexed as British colonies. But the third stage, as I said, is the stage that we're concerned with, the phase of the guerrilla warfare, when the Boer commandos began to return in force to the countryside, which really happens from about September, October 1900 onwards. They're really beginning to take control of the countryside. In December of 1900, or at the very end of November of 1900, Kitchener took over from General Roberts as the commander-in-chief of the British forces. And again, as far as the history of the camps is concerned, that is a decisive moment. And then about February of March of 1901, Kitchener began to launch the scorched earth policy, which was the policy, and I'll be saying a bit more about that, which devastated the countryside and led to the rounding up of all the country people and bringing them into camps. And the war ended, of course, with the 31st of May 1902, when the Treaty of Rheinachen was signed. But as I mentioned very briefly at the beginning, what was happening in South Africa was not unique. There are increasing numbers of scholars now working on these colonial camps, and I'm in fact going to two conferences next year where people are working on these. The Germans are particularly interested, but there are a number of other people working on these camps as well. The one which is best known, the example which is best known, is that of Cuba. In 1896, General Weyler, who was a Spaniard, was waging war against the Cuban people in their great struggle for freedom. This is an American take on the Cuban War, not North American, United States take on the war. And he did the same sort of thing. It's the obvious thing to do in guerrilla warfare. It's to round up the country people. They were known as the Reconcentrados. And they were sent not into camps in the countryside, but in the towns in Cuba, in makeshift camps where conditions were dire, and they died in their thousands. The Americans, who were about to launch war on Spain themselves, widely publicized the horrors of the Cuban campaign. The British were very well aware, when they started the campaign in South Africa, of the whole whaler campaign in Cuba and what had happened to the Cubans. So it's not as though they were coming, approaching the camps in ignorance. But there was a second episode, as I said, at the same time, between 1899 and 1902, the Americans were waging war on the Filipinos as they tried to establish their control of the Philippines. And this was quite as bloody and vicious a war as the Cuban campaigns or the South African campaigns. The war also involved a guerrilla phase, more scattered, of course, because of the nature of the Philippine Islands. And it's estimated that about 200,000 civilians died in camps, largely from cholera, because, of course, war and disease go hand in hand, as you'll be seeing. Clearing the countryside, as I've said, is an obvious tactic in warfare. But in some respects, these camps were a new phenomenon, and historians have been asking why they are established at this stage. Why were civilians being so managed or mismanaged? And they are arguing that it had much to do with the emergence of the modern professional army and a culture that was engendered in the modern military. I've looked particularly at the work of somebody called Isabel Hull, who wrote this book called Absolute Destruction, which is a study of German military culture between, well, I suppose about 1903 and the First World War, just before that. But she looks at the South African camps as well. And she argues that German military culture of the period tended towards extremism, this institutionalized extremism. And she defines it in this way, that extremism occurs when the means overwhelms the end, when violence is pursued because the institution keeps on generating violence according to quasi-automatic mechanisms. Following necessary seeming routines, military extremism gravitates towards final or total solutions. And I found this very convincing, and it seems to me we've seen plenty of evidence of this in recent years worldwide. But as I said, she looks also at the South African camps. And she emphasizes that German violence against the Herero and the Nama was only at the extreme end of a continuum which embraced most modern armies. In other words, what Kitchener was doing in South Africa was not significantly different from Lothar von Trotter, who was the German general in German Southwest Africa. Kitchener may well have behaved quite as ruthlessly as Lothar von Trotter, but he's operating in a different political system. Kitchener was restrained by a political system which contained him. In other words, a system with a parliamentary government, an elected parliamentary government, which had to be responsive also to an electorate and had to be mindful of an electorate. The German, Lothar von Trotter, had a much freer hand under the German political system, she argues. Anyway, let's turn to some of our key figures in this war and in the story of the camps. The dominant figure, of course, the decision maker in the war itself, was Herbert Lord Kitchener, who became Commander-in-Chief at the beginning of 1900. Kitchener was the ultimate military man. I have to warn you that I don't admire Kitchener. So if I'm unfair to him, I apologize, but I find him a cold-hearted man. His ambition was to end the South African War as quickly as he could, because he was hoping to be appointed to India. All through this war, Kitchener is looking across to India. His ambitions lie in India. So his objective then is to put an end to this war as quickly as he can, and then he's stuck with this guerrilla warfare, which is so frustrating. He was also a man who was so secretive about his policies that the War Office, seems to me, often had little idea of what was happening, and the Colonial Office had no idea at all. They often got their information through the newspapers. On the other hand, unlike Milner, Kimberly, Kitchener didn't really mind how he ended the war. He was prepared to negotiate an end to the war. And particularly he pinned his hopes on the Middleburg talks of February 1901, which failed. And it's after the failure of those Middleburg talks that he becomes much more ruthless in his treatment of the enemy and his determination to end that war, because he sees no hope for negotiation with the Boers at that stage. And it's this point then that he introduces the scorched earth policy, which, as I've said before, was an obvious strategy in guerrilla warfare to clear the veldt to ensure that there is no help for the commandos. But I would emphasize that for Kitchener, certainly, this strategy, the clearing of the veldt, the removing of the families to camps, was a strategy of war. It was not a humanitarian gesture. The other major figure in the camps, of course, is Sir Alfred Milner. He became Lord Milner on the 1st of July of 1901. He went over to England and he was given a peerage. And he's a very complex figure. I find Milner perpetually fascinating, I have to confess. I don't admire him, but he has one feature which I think is appealing to myself as a woman. Milner was very much an administrator rather than a politician. He knew nothing about compromise. He is a rotten compromiser. He wants to get his own ends all the time. And he gets absolutely paranoid at times in his correspondence. As far as the camps were concerned, I'm going to be talking about him in relation to the camps, but he had little knowledge really of the camps, extraordinarily little knowledge of the camps, until November of 1901. And he wasn't really interested. His sights up until that point are in establishing a British regime on the Rand. As I've said, I do think he has got one feature which I found attractive, and that was that he liked intelligent women. He spent extraordinary lengths of time walking with people like Lady Milner. Of course, he was having an affair with her ultimately, but Lady Edward Cecil. But other women, he spent a lot of time with women talking about politics with these women. And consequently, he was willing to work with the Ladies' Committee, which I'll be talking about later on as well. I think from the perspective of the camps, Milner's great irresponsibility, perhaps, lies in the fact that he ignored the mounting death toll until the information was forced upon him. On the other hand, once he grasped the scale of the mortality, together with Joseph Chamberlain, the Secretary of State for the Colonies, he took vigorous steps to improve conditions. But just before I finally get to the whole question of the camps, I also want to make one other point. And this is the fact that a man like Milner, along with Chamberlain, is drawing on a very different set of traditions from a military man like Kitchener. And these traditions, I think, shape the way in which the camps are handled. Because these South African camps are not the first camps which England established. Let me remind you that whenever you look at South Africa, over there is India. There is a fascinating dialogue in the history of South Africa and India. And so often, in so many situations, with the history that I do at any rate, I find that people are looking to India for their example. And it's in India that the camp system is first established by the British. They were established first during this terrible famine of 1876-1878, when it's estimated that between 6 and 10 million people died. Absolutely staggering scale. And in order to provide relief to these starving Indians, these famine relief camps were set up. I would add that the relief was grudging, and it was managed by forcing the destitute into these camps, where they could be easily managed, they could be counted, and they could be civilized. And you'll see what I mean in a moment. Because the second set of camps is the plague camps, which were established towards the end of the 19th century. I think the date was about 1894, I can't remember the exact date now. A world pandemic of plague broke out, started in China, spread to India, where it was very severe. And again, something like 10 million Indians died of plague. It's absolutely staggering numbers that we're dealing with in India. But in order to manage the plague epidemic, again, these plague camps were set up. Plague camps were set up for those suffering from the disease, but also for contacts, people who had contact with plague victims. And again, in the camps, it was felt they could be managed, they could be inoculated, they could be taught the rudiments of sanitation. So these camps then also have this kind of modernizing, educative element to them. And indeed, we had our own plague camps, because plague broke out here in Cape Town in February of 1901. This actually is Indabeni after the plague was over. But Pinelands was the site of these plague camps. But there is another set of traditions which shapes the camps as well. I know I'm taking a long time to get to the camps, but I do think one needs to understand these things, because these undiscussed assumptions shape the way people behave. To understand this, we need to go back to Britain's great age of reform in the 1830s. This is the period when Britain's modern world began to be crafted. The Great Reform Act of 1832, which is what this cartoon is about, widened the franchise and began the process of creating a society which was a little less dominated by the landed aristocracy, that paved a way for a society in which modern free market capitalism could function more effectively. But alongside these political changes came changes in the management of the poor, from a paternalist system to one which was more efficient. And it was this act above all which is so critical in understanding 19th century social history in Britain. The 1834 Poor Law Act, which introduced the principle of less eligibility. Essentially what this meant was that relief, poor relief, should be provided only for those who had no other option. In other words, it should be as mean and parsimonious as possible in order to encourage anyone who could to go out and work. So the able-bodied then are expected to work for their food and shelter. The relief was provided in workhouses, which were so unpleasant that only the desperate would resort to them. But this then, above all, was the modern way of providing for the poor within these institutions, and I'm just going to run through a couple of features about them. One of the features is surveillance, watching the people in these workhouses. They had very little freedom once they were committed to a workhouse. Segregation. Husbands and wives were separated. Mothers were separated from their children. So these are highly institutionalized. And then there's this whole thing of preventing pauperization. This word pauperization runs through 19th century British history, this great fear that the poor would become pauperized by giving them anything. So these old ladies, again, even though not able-bodied, are being forced to work for their living. And, of course, the figure who epitomizes the horrors of the workhouse was Dickens' Oliver Twist. He epitomizes the suffering of the poor in the workhouses. The point that I'm trying to make, then, is that for Victorian Britain, the provision of welfare was the job of the modern state. And poor relief should be appropriate to a modern free market society, minimal, managed, efficient. Now, both Chamberlain and Milner were well-versed in poor law ethics. They both had what I think one can fairly call a proud record in the provision of care for the poor, which went beyond the harshness of the workhouses. Both of them brought to the camps a complex heritage of welfare legislation and administration. I'm not trying to suggest that either of these men are humanitarian philanthropists. What I am saying is that they did possess a well-developed ethic of welfare. When they finally confront the mounting toll of the deaths, they knew what they had to do. And this picture is a picture of Toynbee Hall, a community-based charity in London which still exists, where Milner worked as a young man. So let's turn now, get back to South Africa. I try to argue then that the establishment of the South African concentration camps needs to be seen in a wider context. That when people act under pressure, their behavior is determined by their entrenched ethnic or social cultures or their moral values. At the end of the 19th century, we're living in an era when the modern world was in crisis, and South Africa was the place, that South African war was the place where those values were tested. As in the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, people measured their values in this crisis. Do you stand for the global empire, for power, for gold, or do you stand for the rights of small people, for freedom, for independence? This is a very modern war in that respect. And this is, you get lots of, we all know about the young men who came across to fight for the Boers in these various volunteer commandos. But this is one man I'm particularly attached to, who was a Russian author called Konstantin Porstovsky, who wrote a wonderful autobiography in several volumes. But as a young man in Kiev, he writes with great passion about the Boer cause. So it's reaching faraway Kiev, where people are seeing the Boers as standing for freedom against imperialism. For Afrikaners, however, the concentration camps have had an entirely different meaning. F. Offen Jarsfeld, who wrote quite a lot about the understanding of the meaning of history for Afrikaners, made this point that the concentration camps captured the imagination of the people in a way that very few other occurrences have ever done. The concentration camps, too, were to become a symbol and produce their martyrs. So he's identifying the history of the camps and the creation of the camps as one of the most critical events in the formation of Afrikaner identity. In the terrible post-war period, as Afrikaners rallied as a people, the memory of the camps was to be a crucial formative influence in their vision of a society, of a people forged by suffering. And this became, of course, the great symbol of the camps. I'm going to come back to the Women's Monument, the Vrouw Monument, in my last lecture. But I really use this as a symbol here to make the point that as a result of this sort of entrenching of the camps as part of the ethnic identity of Afrikaners, the history of the camps became quite literally frozen in stone, encapsulated in the Vrouw Monument in Bloemfontein. And along with that, there came the counting of the deaths. Again, I'll be mentioning this later on, but a man called P.L.A. Goldman, who was Louis Botha's private secretary, was asked by Botha to count up all the Republican deaths during the wars, but the focus has really been on the deaths in the camps, and he calculated that the total number of deaths in the camps was 27,927. And the number on the monument excludes the men, so the monument contains only the women and children. And images like these also have framed the history of the camps as places of suffering and death. This is an image of Bathuli Camp. And yet, having said all this, one comes across the problem that there were relatively few histories of the camps written. Essentially one between my book and the ending of the war, 1902. These are the three major works that were that existed for many, many years. There was J.C. Otto's book, Die Konzentrationskämpfe, which was the first general of history of the camp ever written, published in 1954, was a doctoral thesis from Pretoria University. There was J.L. Hutton's Die Irini Konzentrationskampf, which is a good sound study of a single camp. And there is J.B. Spies's book, Barry Spies's book, Methods of Barbarism, which is not a history of the camps per se, but a history of camp policy. It's a very good book, but it's not actually about the camps. It's about why Robertson, Kitchener, etc. established the camps and looking at the whole working of the camp policy. you'll probably say, well, you know, what about all the other books that have been written about the camps? What about Emily Hobhouse? What about Elizabeth Neatland? What about Sarah Rahl or Johanna Brunt and many others? I'm not trying to say there's no writing about the camps. What I'm talking about is analytical histories of the camps. Instead, the writing about the camps takes very specific forms. One of the things that fascinated me was the realization when I began to work on the camps that the history of the camps is inseparable from the history of Afrikaners and the creation of Afrikaner identity in the 20th century. In many respects, this is one of the most remarkable stories of our nation, but it's little understood, I think, even by Afrikaners themselves. Being an Afrikaner and speaking Afrikaans go hand in hand. Very shortly after the war, a host of organizations sprang into being, which quite deliberately set about creating a language and a culture for the modern world. I'm not speaking with disrespect. I think it was a remarkable achievement. It wasn't unique. The Irish were trying to do something similar in Ireland with Gaelic, rather less successfully. The Jews were to do the same in Israel with Hebrew. But for a small nation of defeated people, it was an astonishing feat of intelligence and tenacity. When you create a new language, you need to provide, amongst other things, materials for people to read. So one of the things that began to happen was the emergence of a literature for people. And these are two examples. These are both magazines, popular magazines for ordinary Afrikaners, which were published or started to be published shortly after the war. The one is the Boere Vrou, which has got a fascinating history, actually. It was edited by a woman called Mabel Malerba, but I don't have time to go into that. The other was the Huisgenoot. The Huisgenoot that exists now is a very impoverished version of what was really a very remarkable journal. The old Huisgenoot was a fascinating journal. It contained information on a whole range of things. It was, by modern standards, a highly cultural journal with articles about music, about art, about Europe, all sorts of things. But one of the things that certainly one of the editors of the Huisgenoot wanted to do was to teach Afrikaners their own history. And he particularly used Gustav Preller for this purpose. So both these journals then are partly about shaping an Afrikaner identity, teaching Afrikaners about themselves. And yet they never write about the camps. And one finds the same thing in the school books. I think partly this has much to do with the way in which history was taught in the past. Certainly when I was at school, my history stopped at about 1900, and this went on right up until about the 1970s, before they began to teach more contemporary history. There's another feature about the way in which history was taught in schools. History was men's history, it was political history, or it was about wars. And the camps are women's history. So they just didn't get much into the school histories. You'll get a paragraph in some of the Afrikaans school history books, but very little. Instead, what you begin to get, because having said that these people don't write about the camps, one's then got to say, how then did Afrikaners learn about the camps? How is the memory of the camps transmitted? And I've suggested that it is transmitted through the creation of this kind of sacred history, through this haze of popular memory. And this term haze is not mine. It's the term coined by Isabel Hoffmeyer, looking at the work of Gustav Preller and the way in which Gustav Preller transmitted Afrikaner history. But I think it applies very clearly to the camps as well. And one of the means of transmitting the history of the camps then is through the women's testimonies, through the work of Emily Hobhouse, Elizabeth Neatland, M.M. Posma, Tante Mim Fischer and her Kamp Dagboek, Johanna Brandt, Sarah Rahl, and I'll be referring to some of these women later on. Emily Hobhouse is the one who creates this genre of the women's testimonies. In these two books that she published, The Brunt of the War and Where It Fell, which was published immediately after the war, which consists of a series of testimonies, and War Without Glamour. And she says that she does this, she uses this means, because in telling their stories, the few spoke for the many who had suffered as they did, but either had no skill in writing, no materials at hand, or who died making no sign. But having said this, we should not take Emily Hobhouse at face value. Emily Hobhouse has been incorporated into the sacred history as well. And I think too many people have been inclined to take what she says at face value. I don't want to denigrate her contribution to the camp. On the contrary, and I'll be saying more about that, I think it was absolutely critical. But what I do want to say is that I think she was an extremely good publicist, an extremely good propagandist. And she's writing not for the Boers, but for an audience in England, or Britain. She's writing for the pro-Boers, but to draw other people into the pro-Boer camp, to gain sympathy for the camps in Britain. And so she's got to market that. And what she does then is to try and appeal to British middle-class sympathies. She knows that what they value is respectability, proper Victorian ladies, stoic, passive, loving mothers. So these are the women that she writes about. Emily Hobhouse never denied the existence of a Boer peasantry, but it's not their stories that she tells. And I put this one in because it's an example of the kinds of women that she associates with. These are the women philanthropists in Bloemfontein, a group of Afrikaans women, Boer women in Bloemfontein, who formed an organization to aid the camps, to raise funds for clothing and to some extent for food. There are quite a lot of photographs of sweets being given to the Bloemfontein kids, and they're lovely, joyous photographs, actually. But my point here is that these are very middle-class women. Mrs. Tibby Steyn, Rachel Steyn, is the wife of President Steyn. Mrs. Blichnote was her sister-in-law. Mrs. Fichart, and if you know your Bloemfontein, you'll know Fichart's stores. Mainie Fleck, who was a major figure, and several other women of this kind. Among them, you get the Levisser family, and the, I'm blank for a moment, the Bowman family, both of them Jewish families in Bloemfontein, who were also active pro-Boer families. So it's these people that she's associated with, people who are kindred spirits, as it were, people that she had a lot in common with. I'm not the only person to comment on the way in which the women's testimonies have been presented. There are two British historians who've written over the past, I suppose, 8 years or so now, called Liz Stanley and Helen Dampier. Helen is actually a South African in origin, but now lives and works in England. And both of these historians, Liz Stanley is actually a sociologist, have worked extensively on the women's testimonies and have presented a much stronger argument about the women's testimonies as being the work of cultural entrepreneurs in a way that I wouldn't quite wish to do. They argue that women like these two, Elizabeth Neertling, Johanna van Warmelo, who's Johanna Brandt, were deliberately crafting their testimonies in the interests of Afrikaner nationalism. In other words, they're saying that these testimonies are highly politicized. I don't think that either Liz Stanley or Helen Dampier would wish to deny the terrible mortality of the camp. Certainly Liz Stanley would not. But I think that they come dangerously close, particularly in the case of Helen Dampier, dangerously close to suggesting that the suffering of the women has been exaggerated for political purposes. I don't, therefore, always agree with what they say, but I do wish to make the point here that the women's testimonies form the bedrock of camp history. This is the way the camps were understood, through the way in which the history was presented in these testimonies. They are presented as I say, a part of a sacred history, but they are not a sacred history. They do need to be looked at analytically. There are another group of people who are also enormously important, I think, in conveying the emotion of the camps and the feeling of the camps. The creation, and again, this is linked to the creation of Afrikaans as a modern language of culture. Because immediately, almost immediately after the war, you suddenly get this flowering of Afrikaans poetry associated with these three men in particular, with Jef du Toit, with Jan Hofseleer, and with C. Louis Leipoldt. They all write about the camps, although Leipoldt was the only one who ever actually visited a camp. One of the most influential is Tertius. Tertius was married into the Pusmod clan, that is the family which was closely associated with the Dupperkerk and with the founding of Potchefstroom University, which is the university, if you remember, for Christelijke Onderwijs. So he's associated with that more conservative element in Afrikaner society. He published two books of poems explicitly associated with the camps and the Vrouwen Monument. He published Rachel to raise funds for the Vrouwen Monument, and then when the Vrouwen Monument was unveiled in 1913, he published a second book called Bailey Monument. So he was very actively engaged in the promotion of a recording of the tragedy of the camps. As I've said, Leipold was the only one who actually visited a camp. He was a young journalist in Cape Town during the war, working on the South African News, which was a pro-Boer newspaper, and he did actually visit Allewelle North Camp. And he was profoundly shocked by what he saw and wrote a number of poems drawn from this experience. Can't go through all the poems, but I use this poem quite a lot, which is the one by Yonef Silier, for two reasons. One is that it's short enough to fit on a slide. And secondly, because it has this very fine translation by Guy Butler. There is another much weaker translation, which just shows you how good Guy Butler's translation is. So I'm going to go through it very briefly in English. Gold, blue, felt sky, and one bird wheeling lonely high. That's all. An exile come back from over the sea, a grave in the grass, a tear breaking free. That's all. I think it captures most beautifully the emotion, the tragedy of the camps. And the point that I'm making in looking at this poetry, in talking about this poetry, is that I think it became deeply embedded in Afrikaner consciousness. Because these poems were in school books. Children learnt these poems. I had certainly had this all at school. And I think probably most Afrikaans children learnt a number of these poems, knew many of these poems. So it seems to me then that it's especially through poetry that a sense of the tragedy and of the horror and of the bitterness of the camps was conveyed. I have spent some time looking at the way in which the camps are remembered, because it seems to me it's integral to the history of the camps. But this creation of a sacred history has two disadvantages. One disadvantage is that people have felt that the story is already told. I had an odd experience a couple of years ago when I wrote an article for a journal, and one of the readers said, "We don't need to publish this article. We know the story already. There's nothing more to be said." So this is one thing then. But the other problem is that what has happened is that this history has become fixed. There has been an endless recycling of the same story over and over again. It's a mythology, then, I've suggested, which has not been questioned. And indeed, to question can and does rouse great anger. And just to explain what I mean briefly by this mythology of suffering and what happens when you begin to get it in this way, one of the problems is that the extreme is taken as the average. The dreadful conditions of Bathuli camp are seen as the norm. And I'm going to be talking about Bathuli a lot. It is an important camp, but not all camps were like that. One is also left, and this is Emily Hobhouse is responsible for this, with the impression that everyone lost children, and that whole families commonly died out, were killed in the camps, died in the camps. That's not wholly true. I'm not trying to say the mortality wasn't high. Black people, until the 1980s, were entirely excluded from camp history, and I'll be saying a bit more about that later on. And then men had a very odd place in camp history. Men were largely excluded from the history. They're either depicted as old men or as Hensoppers, traitors, those who have taken the oath of neutrality and given up the fight, abandoned the fight, cowards, if you like. Now, this mythology is often conveyed in the face of evidence to the contrary. The camps are wonderfully illustrated in photographs, and one of the reasons why I like doing the PowerPoint presentation is because we can look at some of these photographs, and I'll be saying a little bit more about that as we go along. But this is fairly typical. This particular photograph, or the caption to this photograph, In the book from which I took it, says that the men in the concentration camps were largely those too weary to continue to fight, the old and the maimed. Well, I grant you there are lots of young boys there, but those are not, on the whole, men who are too old to fight. And there are a lot of them. And lots of the photographs show able-bodied men in the camps. And I'll be talking more about my database and the camp registers, but it's possible, once you've got a database, to analyze the number of men in the camps in relation to the women. And what we're looking at is quite a substantial number of men in the camps, nearly a third of the men in the camps. And I've gone and left out, I've just realized, my absolutely critical slide related to the men, which is the age of the men in the camps. So I just have to tell you about that one. The men in the camps were young men. The number of old men is quite small. The men in the camps largely were between the ages of about 20 and 50. They are young men. This mythology went on being elaborated on all through the 1920s and 30s. And the nadir of this kind of camp history really came with this book by Evel Steenkamp called Hell Camp. It was supposedly reputedly banned by General Smuts during the Second World War because the feeling was that it generated such bad feeling amongst Afrikaners. And it's an odd book. It's a mixture of fact and fiction, with the fact sometimes as fictional as the fiction. Works like this one were not left unrebutted. There are two United Party men, particularly, who wrote books in response to this kind of literature. And while I think they were justified in their criticisms, the problem was that they showed little understanding of the meaning of camps for Afrikaners. They wrote their books really at a time when there was a lot of tension between nationalists and the United Party. The one is during the Second World War, the one is just after the Second World War. And they're clearly promoting a United Party cause, the cause of reconciliation between Afrikaner and English. But as I've said, I feel that they did nothing to bridge the divide between English and Afrikaner. The legacy, I think, has been unfortunate because it left many Afrikaners feeling that any English-speaking perspective on the camps is bound to be hostile and patronizing. Anyway, to get finally to the camps, and that's the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse in the background by Dürer, which is an image I'm rather fond of. This is a world at war. One of the things that happens in war is that war creates poverty. Men, the breadwinners, are unable to provide. So in every war, this is one of the features that you have to look, you get, and which have been largely ignored in South African writing about war. War also gives rise to great fear, to terror, to uncertainty, to rumour. And part of the history of these camps is the story of fear and of rumour, and I'll be referring to this again later on. And it creates refugees, people on the move. Many people fled terrified before the British forces as the march north began. And I just want to turn now for the last section. How am I doing for time? Okay. I want to be stopping, but we started a little bit late, so I hope you'll let me just go very quickly. Camps have got a variety of origins, but the Alamo North camps is particularly well documented and slightly unusual, because the people in the Alamo North camp all came from the rural Smithfield district in the Free State. And what happened there was that by about November of 1901, the whole region had really fallen to the Boer commandos. Kitchener never provided enough people on the ground to hold the countryside. He thought once Pretoria and Bloemfontein had fallen, that's it. And of course that wasn't it. It's the countryside where it matters. And as I say, by November of 1901, the British had lost control of the rural Smithfield district. The district commissioner of that area, who was quite interested, I mean, they're very interested, these district commissioners, but that's another story. was particularly concerned about protecting both Boer and British who came to him for protection. And so on the 8th of January of 1901, he trekked across the Orange River with the local people, British and Boer, black as well as white, to Allewell North, where a camp was established just 2 miles out of Allewell North. But on the other hand, Bloemfontein, for instance, was a camp which just kind of appeared as Bloemfontein became more and more crowded, people began to have to live in tents, and so it just emerges without any kind of real origins at all. So you've got these very contrasting ways in which the camps emerged. What lay, of course, behind the camps was the blockhouse system and the drives, the scorched earth policy, which I'm sure that many of you are familiar with. Just to remind you that what Kitchener did was to divide the country up by blockhouses and barbed wire, and then to have these drives of his men across the countryside, rounding up everything, destroying anything edible, destroying anything which might give help to the commanders. And in the process, the families were brought in. And this, as I've said, is a period of women on the move. And with these drives particularly, and I looked in my book particularly closely at the first drive of Major General French, which took place in the Petre Tief sort of Staderton, that sort of area, across to the Drakensberg. And it was a drive to try and capture Louis Botha. And just the 2 points that I want to make about this drive is, first of all, the British, which are an extraordinarily clumsy sort of thing. I mean, it was 5 miles of wagons carrying food and stuff in the beginning. But the British had 14,000 men on the drive. Louis Botha had 4,000. But as the British advanced, the families left their farms. They fled along with the commandos. And the consequence of this was that Louis Botha had to siphon off about 1,500 of his men to look after the families. I do not see personally how the guerrilla warfare could have continued if the British had not begun to pick up these families and take them into the camps. I don't see that the Boer forces would have been able to continue to fight if they had to be caring for their families at the same time. So it seems to me, in a sense, the camp system helped to extend the war. The other point that I wanted to make about these drives was the length of time it often took the families to get into the camps, because they would have to go along with the drive, with the marching soldiers. They ran out of food. It would take them weeks before they got into a camp. The conditions in this particular drive, the weather broke, it was wet, it was cold, they were in the Drakensberg, it was awful. And then they finally end up in a place like Standerton, which was mired in mud and was so dreadful that when the first medical officer arrived, he took one look and left. Couldn't even stay. About 30,000 farms were destroyed during these drives. And for many women, it's the loss of their homes and their possessions, which was so traumatic. And I wanted to conclude just with one excerpt. This is one from Emily Hobhouse, about the way in which one woman responds to the burning of her possessions. She went almost frantic, fell down on her knees before the officer, took hold of his hands and cried, "Oh, look at your soldiers carrying out my beautiful furniture. See what they are doing." For they had made a big fire and were heaping on it her pillows and feather beds. And out of the house, the soldiers came running, carrying her silver candlesticks and all sorts of things, tables, chairs, clocks, etc. "What are you doing? What are they doing?" she cried out. "What are you doing with my things?" And then finally, just to stop, and I'll put this one up at the beginning of my next lecture, but the camps then were established always along the railway lines. I don't have a pointer here, but you'll see a small group of camps down here, which were established only in 1902, and many of the Natal camps were established also in 1902 to bring people down from the Free State and the Transvaal. But the bulk of these camps are along these railway lines, and these are black camps as well as white camps. There were more black camps than there were white camps, something like 35, 36 white camps and about 40 black camps. And if I'm a bit vague about the numbers, it's because you get kind of in between camps. You get camps that are established late, that sort of thing. Okay, thank you.